The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Janine Pollock, and I'm the head of the Rare Book Department. It is now my pleasure to introduce Donald Fagen. This visionary musician and songwriter of acerbic wit and sly delivery is best known as the co-founder, along with Walter Becker, of the rock band Steely Dan. Also an accomplished solo artist, his fourth solo album, Sunken Condos, was released in 2012. He is also a frequent collaborator. I discovered in my extensive research on Wikipedia that he played on an album with Ricky Lee Jones, whose cover of one of my favorite songs, Show Business Kids, is glorious, by the way. And most recently, he has toured with Boz Scaggs and Michael McDonald, more about which here. In Eminent Hipsters, Donald Fagen, through a series of vignettes, paints a sonic picture of the foundational musical experiences and other traumas that shaped his artistic development. For anyone who's ever thought upon hearing a Steely Dan tune, dude, where'd you get that? This is your jam. If you're a television baby and recognize yourself in the second half of the book, counselors are standing by. He will be interviewed by David Dye, who has been turning us in Philadelphia on to what's good in music for as long as I can remember, and over the airways of NPR since 2005. His program, World Cafe, features contemporary sounds from legendary and emerging artists. Many of us also fondly recall his days at WMMR when it played progressive rock, and WIOQ when it was an alternative radio station. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Donald Fagen and David Dye to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
So we're taping this for the World Cafe, so now you get another mini introduction as well, which is, I think our audience here at the Free Library in Philadelphia knows full well who we're talking with today. He is the co-founder of Steely Dan with Mr. Walter Becker. They've released 9 incredible albums. He has 4 solo albums, including the latest, Sunken Condos, that came out last year, and now he is an author. We're very, very happy to welcome to the World Cafe Mr. Donald Fagen. So I guess since we are at the Free Library, the first question should be about writing. A couple of these pieces, in fact, a number of these pieces were from magazine pieces and things you did for Slate before. But talk a little bit about why you decided to put this together and put it together, as you call it, an autobiography at this point.
Well, I didn't really plan to write a book, but let's see. I used to write for my high school newspaper a little bit, but I really didn't write any prose for years. And then in the 80s, I was experiencing a bout of writing block as far as songwriting went. And I knew this woman who was just given the job as editor of Premier magazine, Susan Line, and she asked me if I wanted to do a film music column. So even though I didn't know much about film music, I thought it might be good therapy. So I did 4 or 5 of them. And it was fun, and then other people started asking me to write about various subjects, and like Slate.com later on, if a famous musician died, they'd always call me to write an appreciation or whatever,
One of the things you did for Premiere was that Ennio Morricone interview, which is really a wonderful little piece in this book. Very funny. Tell me about that experience.
Yeah, they told me Ennio Morricone, the famous Italian film music composer, was in town, and they sent me over to this hotel. You know, I had a little tape recorder and all that, and he really couldn't speak English very well, so there was a translator, but you know, I had all these questions prepared, and of course, this was in the 80s, and especially at that time, a lot of people had sort of discovered these scores, you know, that he wrote for those early spaghetti westerns with Clint Eastwood. It was, you know, peculiar, you know, all those things, you know. And, you know, there's a lot of guys in downtown New York who were doing these kind of meta versions of his stuff. So, you know, I asked him about that, but he I could see right off he was a just a journeyman composer, and he really couldn't care less about that and didn't know anything about it. So it came out kind of funny.
Yeah, know? Definitely. Another one of those pieces was the one about Henry Mancini, who... it's one of the pieces I really loved in here, because I always sort of saw Henry Mancini as kind of a popularizer, and but you knew a lot of his earlier work, and your viewpoint was a little bit different.
Well, yeah, you know, I was about maybe 11 when this show Peter Gunn came on TV, and it was kind of an introduction to modern jazz, because he was... he decided to write a real jazz score, and it was probably the first show to use cool jazz as a sort of core idea for scoring. And it was, you know, that along with a few other things was my introduction to jazz, which, you know, I became a big jazz fan as ever afterwards.
Yeah, what were the other things that kind of led you that way? I mean, you were playing piano at that point already, right?
I started piano actually around the same time I started late, because my parents bought a piano for my sister to take lessons, and I had for a couple of years, I had been a jazz fan listening to these late night... I live in New Jersey, but I listened to these late night broadcasts out of Manhattan. There were several of them in those days. This was in the late 50s, early 60s. And, you know, I became a real fan. I just subscribed to Downbeat and all that kind of stuff. And so when we got a piano, I found I could pick out, you know, stuff I heard on records. Not easily, but I, you know, slowly began to develop a vocabulary of moves I could make, you know. So I took a few lessons too, but mainly self-taught.
Wow. I'd love to talk a little bit about your late night radio listening, because you also listened to Gene Shepherd, who was on WOR, and people who, yeah, I figured there were some Gene Shepherd fans here as well. Tell me a little bit about that experience. You also had the experience of seeing him live, but that was later.
I did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I had a kind of bohemian uncle, my Uncle Dave, who, you know, he was, I guess, babysitting for me, or just, watching me when I was about 10, 11, about the same age. And at one point, we were playing cards, and he said, "Look, I'm going to listen to Shepherd." And so he puts on the radio, and there was this guy telling these fantastic stories, and it was funny. And it also, he sounded like, there was a quality about Gene where it sounded like he was talking directly to you. You know, it was very personal, and he was a riot, you know, and... so after, you know, after that, I became a Gene Shepherd fan, and you know, every weeknight I'd you know, keep the radio really low so my parents couldn't hear it, and I'd listen to Gene Shepherd. Yeah,
he would go on for hours.
Well, at one point when he first started, he had a show that he'd actually talk extemporaneously for like 5-6 hours, but then. By the time I really started listening to him, he had a 45-minute show.
Wow. You described growing up in Kendall Park
as being
really kind of isolated, but there was a plus side to that because you had all these probably very different interests than a lot of your schoolmates. For instance, you were a science fiction reader, and there's a part in this book about this whole thread of science fiction. The Institute of General Semantics, corticothalamic pause, all this A.E. van Vogt stuff I'd never even heard of. And you really kind of drilled down with that. Tell me about that piece. When did you write that piece?
I just wrote that piece just because I was always interested in... I could see there was this kind of thread running through science fiction that had to do with a book by a... certain Count Korzybski, who wrote a book called Science Insanity, which was kind of a big deal in the 40s among, you know, certain people who were interested in, you know, I guess what was then, now would be called, you know, human potential or mind expansion or something. And, you know, it was kind of a... It was, I guess you'd call it a self-help book, but it was so involved and so complicated that it's almost unreadable, actually. John Campbell, who used to put out these science fiction magazines, was very taken with it and encouraged his roster of science fiction writers to include a lot of the ideas in the stories. And his roster included, you know, Heinlein and Philip K. Dick and... Right. And A.E. van Vogt and so on. So if you read a lot of science fiction from the 50s and early 60s, you can see a lot of these ideas in those stories and novels.
Kamakiriad, your solo album, kind of has a science fiction basis.
Thank you.
Does any of that relate to Kamakiriad?
Well, not too much, except for the fact that, you know, it made me look forward towards a kind of mutancy that might develop as far as, you know, at the end, this guy who's got this kind of sci-fi car that he's driving to somewhere, I don't know, there's a kind of, you know, it's because it was an album... I didn't want to make it too specific, you know, it was more of a kind of almost kind of allegory or whatever, but at the end he's sort of poised to, you know, drive this car into the future, you know, and you're not sure, he's obviously going to change into something else, and maybe to that extent.
Haven't we already passed the point in time that album was in? It was the near future.
The near
very,
future.
Very near future, indeed.
It's like near beer.
Exactly. One more kind of question about that period. You were lucky enough to be able to go into New York to, even as a minor, to go see some amazing jazz and clubs in New York. Who were you most, who did you most love seeing live?
There was a lot of stuff. You know, I started going, my older cousins that would take me to see jazz starting from when I was about 9 or 10. And then I started going myself, taking the bus into Manhattan and going to different clubs, the Vanguard, or and then later on to a really out-of-the-way place called Slugs. I was just so amazed to be seeing live jazz. And it was a great time for live jazz. You know, I saw Coltrane and Coltrane's quartet. I saw... Charles Mingus many times because I really liked him, and I got to see some older guys like Earl Hines and Coleman Hawkins had a group in the early 60s, and he was still playing great. And I think Bill Evans quite a few times, and he was a favorite of mine.
You talk in the book about seeing Willie the Lion Smith too, who's mm-hmm. the great stride player.
Yeah, he was terrific. And I remember when I went to see Willie, his wife was sitting near the piano, and I happened to be sitting next to her. And I remember, you know, I was maybe, well, at that time I was maybe 15 or 16, but I got to talk to her a bit, and that was a lot of fun too.
What was the transition to going to Bard like for you? Were you just really anxious to get there and totally prepared, or was it a different world?
This is Bard College, where I went to school, which was kind of a very small liberal arts college, and a cousin of mine went there. I had a lot of cousins. And,
a lot of uncles.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It was just like, I think anyone who goes off to school, I had a real sense of, it was the first time I'd actually left my, parents' home. So I think it was actually a lot more traumatic than I might have known at the time. It's a complicated subject. Do you have a specific...
Well, I was wondering about... You felt really isolated. This is like, that's like we're doing therapy or something. you were talking about being really kind of isolated in New Jersey. I was kind of, you found your crew or something at Bard.
Yeah, I mean, I found people, I went to, my parents moved to this housing development when I was 10 or 11. That was very isolated. It was built on farmland. It had just been built. So these big mounds of dirt still on every corner, and these little trees that were had a piece of wire around them to hold them up and all that. And some of the houses were not occupied yet. And my father actually worked for the guy who built it. He had gotten this job, sort of like that movie Poltergeist. You know that? In fact, I expected coffins to come out of the ground. It's like in that movie, but I found it to be very isolating, and so when I went off to school, I did find people, like-minded people. There were musicians, there were some jazz fans, and all that.
And you met Mr. Walter Becker. I guess you heard his guitar playing before you met him.
Yeah, I had already been there like 2 years. I was in about 12 different bands by then, little pickup bands, jazz bands, and rock bands, blues bands, and so on. And but they were all a little bit unsatisfying. And then I heard this kid practicing in this, it was like a little campus club kind of. And he sounded, very professional, and he had a real sort of authentic sounding touch and all that, blues touch and all that. So I went up to him and I said, "Hey, it sounds good," and we started talking, and then we started writing songs together, and we're still together, wow. Trying to do something good.
That seemed to have worked out. Was there music you remember him turning you on to, or things he did?
Yeah, he had, he was, I was in a very small room in this dormitory they had there, but he was lucky he scored this big room in what used to be a mansion, which they converted into a dorm. It was called Ward Manor, right on the Hudson. It was gorgeous. It was kind of falling apart, but we didn't care about that, right. So... And he had this roommate named Randall, who was this kind of this really witty character. He used to make fun of us a lot. But Walter brought these. He was pretty young. I think he was 17 when he got to Bard, and he rolled in these big Ampeg speakers, monitor speakers, and he used to practice and. Tracks, and stuff like that. But he played me some great stuff that I hadn't heard previously. I remember for the first time hearing a Laura Nero records that had just come out. And he played me like Howlin' Wolf records for the first time. I'd never heard that much. I'd heard Muddy Waters, but he knew a lot about Chicago blues and all that. And he, We had a lot of similar interests in music, literature, and that sort of stuff, you know. And we had the same sense of humor, essentially.
I've always assumed that My Old School was written about Barn. And are there things in that song that are specifically about people that are autobiographic?
Well, I think like any like fiction writer, it's kind of this. We combine characters, or you know, there's. It's I wouldn't you know take it that literally, but what happened was in just before I was about to hand in this senior thesis, there was huge drug bust. The assistant DA in Dutchess County then was a guy named G. Gordon Liddy. And this was 1969, and he was up for re-election, decided if he busted all the long hairs at Bard that it might enhance his chances, you know. So he rounded up like 50 kids, and Walter and I were two of those 50. So, you know, that I think that influenced the song a little bit.
Yeah, I guess so. Not going back. Our audience here might be interested in a part of the book where you kind of indicate that your interest in drugs, particularly smoking pot, kind of faded early. It became an unpleasant
experience.
Yeah,
I was never a big drug person. I had this was back in the mid, you know, there was no pot in my high school back then. I mean, there was nothing like that. But when I got to college, you know, there was a lot of pot smoking. I was a casual pot smoker, but I did have an interest in LSD. Because a friend of mine who went to Brandeis had come back the summer before I went to Bard and with these sugar cubes, you know, with LSD on it. And I knew, I actually read a lot about Timothy Leary, who back then, this is before he sort of made a fool of himself and became a big drug guru. He had been fired from Harvard for giving, you know, experimenting on students. But he had put out this book that was a kind of a guide to having a, you know, fruitful experience on LSD called The Psychedelic Experience. And so I knew about that book. And you were supposed to take it with another person as a sort of guide or a therapist who didn't take it, you know, as a safeguard. And I actually did this with this friend of mine, and it was fantastic. And so I was interested in that, but by the time, I think a year or two later, I, you know, lost interest in it, and I figured I got about as much out of it as I could. And after that, I really stopped taking drugs, and I was never a drinker, so I was kind of... you know, a killjoy, really.
I have to read what you wrote about that trip from the. For some reason, I marked this. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, cruising at twilight through the carefully graded streets of Kendall Park in my beat-up 55 Ford Galaxy, I understood for the first time that all was as it should be, that the future was blazing with promise, and that despite all the jeers, Garden State might be a swell name for New Jersey after all.
Yeah. Yeah, and acid, you know, New Jersey is the Garden State, you know?
Yeah. A lot of flowers. So, Donald, the second part of this book is a tour diary where you let your inner curmudgeon fly. Is touring as I mean? It sounds like not a great experience in here. I mean, there are parts of it that are the onstage parts seem pretty good, except for some off nights or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that is sort of how you make your living now too. So it's interesting. How do you combine mm-hmm. the?
Well, first of all, and this is something that a number of reviewers have failed to mention, that the You know, they'll quote me saying something, you know, about the audience or about, you know, my opinion about something. But they fail to mention that the point of it is that actually there is a personality disorder that develops on tour, which I call acute tour disorder, ATD. And I actually concocted a sort of medical description of it like you'd find on the internet if you looked up, you know, psoriasis or something
right.
like that
right.
for ATD. And you really, you know, it's really an altered state of mind after you're out for about 3 weeks or something like that. And so that a lot of the things I say, which may seem negative or bitter, or whatever, is I was actually, you know, I was, you know, experiencing this ATD, and it's just not my normal state of mind, really.
So you're off the hook.
Definitely. It wasn't really me. It wasn't me.
Right. Well, I can see waking up in a bus next to a dumpster night after night, probably, we get to you,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. But in the early years, Steely Dan... Obviously, you were off. You were kind of out of the business there for a few years. But you were at the very beginning, not really keen on touring either. It seemed like it took a while for you to get it so that it would sound good enough.
Well, in the 70s, the group was thrown together very quickly, and you know, Walter and I were mainly interested in making records. This was our main, you know, desire really, and. We were working as staff writers for ABC Dunhill in Los Angeles. We'd gotten this job, $100 a week. It was pretty good. And but we had this other book of these other songs that, you know, we needed to be in a band as a vehicle for these particular sorts of, this kind of material. And so the president of ABC Dunhill... finally gave us the budget to make a record, and so we called some guys we knew from the East Coast, and they came in, and we made the record, and then it hit right out of the box. And the record company said, great, you're going out on tour. And we'd never played live, really, with these guys. And you know, it was... They were great, you know. They had a lot of enthusiasm. They were really into it, but it wasn't the best matchup, both musically or, you know, definitely personality wise. There were some problems. So we toured for 2 years, and then we called it quits.
How has the nature of collaborating with Walter changed over the years? Because I've heard you describe it as a true collaborative thing. You'll sit down and actually, it's not like somebody comes in with a melody and somebody comes in with the lyrics. It's a true collaboration, or it has been.
Well, that will happen sometimes, but generally speaking, I think it's more, it's not like we go off and each write a song and then come in and you know, fix them up or something. We sit in a room and he's got a guitar and I'll be playing the piano and you know, one of us will have an idea for something, and then perhaps the other guy will amend the idea and make it a little better, and then, you know, we'll... there's different ways you can start. You can start with a thematic idea, which is to say, for the lyrics, a little stretch of music, maybe, or a little hook line, or even just some phrase or something like that, and then we'll just like kick it around together. You know, we'll you know, joke, make a lot of jokes and start laughing, and you know, write the thing together. So I think it is a true collaboration.
Yeah. And he produced Stuckin' Condos, or not?
He helped produce Comicariad. My second album.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then you worked on his solo album with him.
Yes.
Yeah,
his first one, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have some questions from the audience, I believe, as well. So
Ah, the cards.
The cards. Huh. It's a good one on top. How much did the Beat Generation writers influence you as a young man?
Well, I did read. I was into that kind of stuff in high school, maybe even before. I think the thing that was interesting to me about those guys, they weren't all the greatest writers in the world, I don't think. And I even knew that then. But they had a kind of alternate view of culture, society, and even an alternate view of American history that seemed made more sense to me than the mainstream history, you know. And I also think they took into account certain psychological realities about people that that you didn't hear in mainstream media and so on. And I particularly enjoyed William Burroughs' things, although it wasn't like you could actually read Naked Lunch, really. But just the thing that the fact that it existed amazed me, you know, especially, you know, in those days. And there's a few guys that I really like. There was a guy named Ted Jones. He spelled his name Joans, a black poet that was really good. And I liked Lawrence Ferlinghetti's work as well.
What do you think about yacht rock and nostalgia for the 70s?
Yeah, I saw those yacht rock YouTubes. I thought they were funny. As far as nostalgia goes, I'm not really into nostalgia so much.
Do you listen to classical music?
Say it again, I'm sorry?
Do you listen to classical music?
I studied some music in school, and I like Baroque music, like Bach and Handel particularly, Telemann. Then this guy kind of skipped through the Romantic age, and then I like some late 19th century French music, and like Poulenc and Debussy, Ravel, that kind of thing. And I'm a particular fan of Stravinsky. I think he was, he sits like over here to me. He's like, he never makes an error in taste, or very rarely. He's something else. Especially people mainly know the early ballets of Stravinsky, Petrushka, Rite of Spring, and Firebird and that, but his middle and late period works are super and very different, but they're beautiful.
You mentioned he's one of the people you mentioned is listening to in the tour diaries, and you also mentioned Paul Desmond and the great Getz Meets Mulligan album. Mm-hmm. Are there other like go tos for you? Other albums that you still go back to?
Yeah, I still listen to a lot of the same albums I did in high school. Sure. I mean, there's so many that, that was the 50s and 60s had so much good jazz, but I particularly like those prestige records that the Miles Davis Quintet made with Red Garland and Philly Joe Jones, John Coltrane, and Paul Chambers. I like Charles Mingus records from the early 60s with John Handy and Booker Irvin. Dave Brubeck Quartet, especially live recordings, because Paul Desmond could really fly live, especially. I love Sonny Rollins and, a lot of stuff. And, you know, as I started getting into jazz, I started listening to the historical stuff, too, like a lot of bebop, a lot of Charlie Parker, Bud Powell, and And before that, so I got into Duke Ellington's early work starting in the 20s and 30s and all that.
Mm. Another question, what kind of advice would you give to a student who wants to study music and have a career in music today?
Advice? Well, listen to the stuff I just mentioned, and it may not be completely necessary to go to music school. I think you have to learn technique on your instrument if you play an instrument, I think, and you could do that maybe with private lessons or something, but like a lot of people who come out of there's a few jazz programs now, but a lot of the guys who come out of the jazz programs all sound the same. They learn from these books of patterns and scales and patterns, and you can't tell one guy from the next. It's like, I think, the more you can do by yourself and put yourself into it, the better you're going to, because like these old guys, like me. So I'm not a great jazz player, but there are some, like people like Sonny Rollins, going back to Louis Armstrong or whatever, their styles were so defined, they were such individuals that's what makes them great, and they didn't go to jazz school,
Right. Here's a question that when reading the book, I kind of thought of myself. Is Nightfly based on your youth and some of the same material in the book?
Yeah. I mean, you mean the song or the...
Well, I didn't indicate, but maybe, yeah.
The song Nightfly is about a late night talk radio DJ. I think Gene Shepherd was probably, the model for that, yeah.
Were you into the International Geophysical Year at high school?
Yeah, well, it was before high school. I was, that was around 1957, 1958, and I remember they used to have a thing that they used to distribute to kids called the Weekly Reader. Remember the Weekly Reader?
Yeah. Round of applause for the Weekly Reader.
And I remember the International Geophysical Year was a big story in the Weekly Reader,
Yeah. For weeks.
Mm. They really kept that alive all year.
Was Chevy Chase really your drummer at Bard?
I went to school with Chevy at Bard. He was a very good drummer, actually, and he also was a pretty good piano player, too. And Walter and I... we were in pickup bands with him, stuff like that. He was good. And in fact, after school, before we went to the West Coast and started Steely Dan, he came down once and we were thinking of doing a two keyboard thing with him and starting some kind of band. Hmm. But he eventually decided to go into a comedy. He was good. Funny.
That worked for him, too.
It's funny. Bard didn't have a fraternity, but he seemed like he was in a fraternity, what I mean? He was the only guy there who looked like he was in a fraternity.
He does have that look.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Not that I'm stereotyping fraternity types, but... this is a question about who would you like to jam with, and I would sort of extend that. Do you play recreationally? I know you've been to, were at some of Levon Helm's midnight things. And...
Yeah, I used to sit in with Levon on his Saturday night rambles, as he used to call them, and that was a lot of fun. And my stepdaughter also, my stepdaughter Amy, also used to sit in. She was in the band, really. Who's also Levon's daughter. And I like to sit in with people. I once sat in with the Allman Brothers in the Beacon Theater when they do their long couple of weeks at the Beacon. That was fun.
Do you know a song's a hit before it becomes one?
I don't know anything about hits, or I don't know any business, or, you know, I've been just ripped off, you know, upside, downside, every way you can think, you know. I don't know anything about, you know, hits or promotion or anything like that.
There's a bit in the your tour diary about playing Deacon Blues, and that turned out to be, I think that's kind of a surprising hit song in a way.
Well, it was very long.
Yeah.
It was, I forget, it's at least 6 minutes plus, something like that. And, yeah, that was a surprise. That was a hit.
Which was more challenging, and why? Writing your first book or writing that first Steely Dan album?
I don't remember much about writing the first Steely Dan album. I like writing because you don't have to rhyme anything. It takes a big burden off your, you know.
There's a lot of interesting questions in here. What did you do during the blackout in Toronto in 2003?
That's funny. That means that someone knows I was. We were just about to. We were doing a sound check, I remember, in Toronto, and the lights went out. So we hung around in the parking lot near the buses, and we were lucky because the buses have generators, you know. So we were some of the few people who actually, you know, we could watch TV or we could do whatever. It was just like, you know, we didn't really have a blackout, you know.
I met a guy this afternoon who knew I was going to be here, and he has he's a band that features Steely Dan's music, and so he's got some questions. He said, have you actually drank all the exotic drinks in your songs?
No, actually, I rarely drink, so I don't, I haven't, but there's a couple of guys in my band who probably have.
I'm not sure I understand this one, but with your vast catalog discography, what magic do you use to choose a keyboard player to tour with Steely Dan?
I don't know. When one guy quits, we get another guy. I don't know. not much magic involved, really.
However one would define it. I'm coming back to this one because it intrigued me. Have you ever discussed your Torah portion with Bob Dylan?
Say it again.
More than once, I'm sure. Have you ever discussed your Torah portion with Bob Dylan?
Torah portion?
Torah. The Torah.
Let me see.
Yeah.
Oh, they're like what you say when you're bar mitzvahed, you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't. I've met Bob Dylan a couple times backstage. He didn't say much. I remember I asked him, you know, I think for some reason I think he injured his hand, and since then he plays a keyboard instead of a guitar. And I asked him, you know, what kind of keyboard he was using. He went, he said, you got me. Well, I don't know. I have absolutely no idea.
Well, where do you come down on the technological aspect of keyboards? Would you rather play old-school instruments, or does it matter?
I like to play tunable instruments, so I don't play a synthesizer of any kind. I play these old, you know, Rhodes pianos or just acoustic piano or Wurlitzer piano, things that can actually be tuned for various technical reasons, which I won't bore anybody with right now.
But you like the sound. That's what you...
Yeah, I like the sound because you know. Well, you want me to get into it? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're being encouraged.
You know, tempered instruments, which mean like an organ or synthesizers. They're tuned in a way that's really a cheat. Like they tune all the octaves, but it's because of science. They as you go up the keyboard, the notes seem a little flatter towards the top end, and low end sounds a little sharper. Now, what a piano tuner does is, if he comes and tunes your piano, he'll temper it, and then he'll what they call stretch tune it. He'll accommodate this mathematical problem of harmonics by just very carefully stretching the top end so that it's sharpens up the top end and flattens down the low end, and it gives it a very nice musical sound. And you know, organs, synthesizers, any kind of digital instruments, they don't have that. And it's to me, it's very grating when you, and also like when I hear singers sing it, they're like, if you play a chord in the middle of the keyboard, the singer will get their pitch from that. But then if the player hits a high note, that's a little flatter, and then, so there'll be a conflict between what the singer thinks is the pitch, and so that's why I like to use tunable. You know, any something that can be stretch tuned. You know, now most people, I have to say, may not notice, because it's a minute amount. You know, but it's just a beautiful musical quality you get from a stretch tuned instrument. Horn players have a really hard time playing with digital or instruments or synthesizers, because you know, they have to like constantly be adjusting for what range the player is using.
Do you write on an acoustic piano at home, or do you write on other?
Acoustic, yeah.
Yeah.
I have a couple upright pianos in different. I have one in the bedroom and one in the living room.
Always close. If you could have written any song by another artist, wow, what would it have been and why? I guess that's kind of a question about some of your favorite songs.
Well, there's a few Beatles songs I wish I'd written. I don't know. I can't offhand. You know, I like. I don't know. Midnight at the Oasis. I like that song. It's kind of it was overplayed. So
it was.
But it's basically a. I like The Days of Wine and Roses by Henry Mancini.
You talk about Ray Charles in the book.
Well, yeah, Ray Charles, although he wasn't really known as a writer, although he did sort of concoct a lot of songs that had been formerly been gospel songs, you know. But, I mean, I could give you a list, but I'd have to think about it.
Okay. Did you ever meet Henry Mancini?
I didn't, but he wrote after I wrote that a piece originally in Premiere, and he sent me a nice letter. Mm-hmm. And I also got a nice letter from his partner, Blake Edwards, the movie director, about it.
Was writing the book cathartic? Another question, did you slant your stories to make them more palatable?
Well, the tour diary was cathartic, but I actually, you know, I didn't write it thinking it would be in a book. I was just kind of letting off steam at the time because I was mentally ill.
With the disorder. Mm. You seem so shy. How hard is it for you and Walter to get up on stage?
It's not hard anymore. There was a time when I had, you know, a certain amount of stage fright, mostly back in the 70s, though. I kind of, you know, after a while you can get used to anything, you know.
What part of it? I'm worrying about what you were playing, or just looking at the audience? Or?
It's just, you know, lack of confidence and being really self-conscious, I think. And, you know, I think if you're really well-rehearsed and confident about your band and, you know, that they have your back and all that, it makes it a lot easier, you know.
And this, I guess, is somewhat related. Do you find working as a duo and hiring out the rest of the band easier than working as a full band? What are the limitations of working like that?
Well, right now, the guys we've been with, we've been together maybe 7 or 8 years, so it's a real band. You know, we really move together as a band, and it's like it is a band. So.
And a sort of a related question, can we expect any more collaborations with the Rock and Soul Review?
I'd love to, yeah. When, you know, Steely Dan, we can't really tour every single year because there's this kind of thing where you're overexposed and, you know, the ticket sales go down after a couple of years because it's just too much. So on years when we're not out, I've been going out with the Dukes, and it works out pretty good.
Cool. Well, thank you very much, and thanks to this great audience.
Thank you.
Great questions.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.